The Influencer's Edge is brought to you by the Rapid Sales Accelerator. If you're ready to skyrocket your sales by 30% or more in just 90 days, then you need to claim your free training right now. You'll learn 4 words that will compel your prospects to trust you like they were children within the first 3 to 5 minutes of any conversation across any platform and any medium. You'll learn how to give your prospects objection amnesia to crush objections like, I need to talk to my spouse, or I need more time to think it over, or it's too expensive. And finally, you'll get a free recorded audio training that will install unbelievable attitudes for success and wipe out any limiting beliefs. So if you'd like to claim your free training now, go to www.paulrossbook.com. Do it before your competition does it now. Welcome to the Influencer's Edge. This is the place where you come to get the latest breakthroughs, cutting-edge insights, tools, and techniques to leapfrog over the pack in sales, persuasion, and influence. Be sure you visit our website at www.theinfluencersedge.com. And while you're there, subscribe to us via your favorite network. Now sit back, tune in, and enjoy today's episode.
All right, welcome to the Influencer's Edge. Well, this is going to be a really funny episode. We have with us today Jerry Katzman and Heather Pasternak. Now, full disclosure, I knew Heather when she was a little girl growing up, and she was friends with my sister's kids. And what was your nickname back then?
Cookie.
How did that come about? I don't know. You always wanted a cookie? I don't know. But let's get right to business and introduce you guys. So, short bio. Amazon, Netflix, and Paramount have all used Jerry Katzman and the comedy partners. I'm assuming that's you, Heather.
Yeah.
To train their employees to become more compelling, connected, and charismatic. Now, right then and there, let me ask you a question. Can you really, I get funny and compelling, but can you train charisma, or is that something people are born with? There's a distinction, I think, between charm and charisma. So how do you guys define charisma?
Well, charismatic people have something that is sort of undefinable, but they have an authenticity. When you find someone charismatic, there's just something about them that you find that you can identify with. And the way people can access that authenticity is being more comfortable with expressing their vulnerability. Right? So when you see us, so Heather and I come from, our background is we've been teaching stand-up for 20 plus years in LA. In the last month, we've had people do their late night sets on Jimmy Fallon's show. In the last few years, we've had 3 people do their sets on Stephen Colbert shows. We have people writing for Saturday Night Live, What We Do in the Shadows. We have been teaching people how to get up into the upper reaches of comedy. And in order to do that, they have to be able to access their authenticity and their vulnerability. So we've brought that over to the corporate world.
And I would also add, you know, confidence and fearlessness, which, you know, just being able to handle hecklers is like a comedic tool that really can translate to business when, you know, you hear something in a meeting or someone throws you something you weren't expecting. A lot of charisma is just not panicking when something like that happens. And I think that is a teachable skill.
Yeah, keeping your cool. My favorite comedian right now is Taylor Tomlinson.
She's so great. Yes.
I love Taylor. I saw her Netflix specials. I'm just in love with her ability, but she does crowd. She works the crowd. She does crowd so she doesn't get heckled, but I've seen people get heckled. Are there any clues to handling hecklers?
Well, that's a great question. And one of our, associates and clients worked for an advertising company, and he was working for Harley Davidson. And they had pitched, you know, Paul, as you know, when advertising corporate companies pitch a client, they spend sometimes a couple $100,000 on spec ads. So they're hoping, okay, we're going to get Porsche's business. We're going to create a print campaign, a radio campaign, a television campaign, even, you know, filmic things. We're going to spend a lot of money to show them what the real commercials would look like. So they work so hard to get the business. So our friend who was pitching business to Harley Davidson gave them the whole, you know, here's everything we think you should do. And the Harley Davidson executive said to him, "This is the worst ad I have ever seen in my life." You know, that is, and by the way, the reason this all got started was I got called from an advertising company, and they had this exact thing happen. Their ad executives would go up, their creative executives would go up, show the creative that they'd created, and they'd say, "This is terrible." And then the executive would go, "Okay, well, I guess we'll go back to the drawing board," and leave them business on the table. And what the ad company said, they said, "You know, we need our people to be more resilient in the face of opposition. Who right. teach that?" So they found us and they said, "You have videos out there teaching people how to handle hecklers. Can you teach this in a business context?" Now I'll go back to the Harley Davidson story. Our friend who has stand-up training, he's a good stand-up as well, said to him, instead of going, when he heard, you know, your first impulse when someone goes, "This ad is shit," your first impulse is either to get angry or to give
right.
up.
Right.
And that's what happens in stand-up. You either want to yell at them or you want to run away. But that you can't do that in stand-up. It's just not allowed. So you need to access a suite of skills in order to be able to survive. The first is how to get your body into a state of calm and relaxation so that when it happens to you in slow motion instead of just creating a reaction, right?
So it's a somatic thing before it's cognitive. It's somatic response.
Yes. And I mean, we know about your background in neuro-linguistic programming. We know that you know all about this stuff. I mean, I'm always learning. So first, it's the somatic. We have to get our bodies, minds, voices, breathing into a state where we're ready for high performance. And this is something that blows us away because Heather and I work, as we've said, we've worked for Amazon, Netflix, Paramount. We've worked for all manner of companies. And we ask them a question. We say, you know, "Do you know any professional actors, musicians, athletes?" "Yes." "Do any of them go on the field or on stage before warming up their bodies, voices, breathing?" "No." "Do you, when you pitch $1 million account, do you have a formalized physical, vocal, and breathing workout, warm up that you do?" Not a single person raises their hand. How is that possible that every other high performance profession, they all warm up before taking the field, before taking the stage, and not a single business person does that with their voice and body? It's insane. So that's one of the first things we teach.
Totally insane. One of the things, you know, my other career has been, and Heather knows this, my other career has been as a pickup and seduction coach. And I've always trained those guys. You've got to prepare your state of mind. You can't just go out there all nervous and fucked up in the head. You've got to prepare and be calm and outward focused and ready for anything, and then to not be reactive. There's a distinction between being responsive and being reactive. I love this. See, we're already not even having the biography. We're already
Heather,
getting
tell
and also
about the, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, so then we teach you also, it's like, you have to get curious, basically. It's like, how can you be on the other person's side? Get curious about that objective instead of running the opposite direction. And we have skills like, you know, reflective listening that can help you sort of restate and go like, okay, so what I'm hearing is this. And when you can actually pinpoint what's going on, I'll give you an example of how this actually works in stand-up. I was doing a set once, I was doing a show, and a man in the front row was sleeping, that happened in a different show. A man in the front row answered his cell phone, which is so rude, so infuriating. I'm an objectively decent comic, even on my bad days, you know, I've done late night and stuff. So I was like, I was doing fine, but he just did that as if it was like a bar, you know, like I was a television show or something. And I was so upset and I wanted to really like let him have it, but I knew the audience would turn on me if I did. So I was like, how can I get on this guy's side? Like, how can I be on his side of this? And I was like, I asked him who he was talking to, and he said he was talking to his daughter. And I was like, can I have the phone? And he gave me the phone, and I took the phone up with the microphone, and I was like, Do you know how much your dad loves you? I was like, he is in the front row of this show. He doesn't give a shit. Like, he's picking up your calls. And I had the whole audience like in the palm of my hand because I was still acknowledging the reality of what was happening, but I was able to like be on his side about it and sort of like find the silver lining. So I think that is a really fun thing to practice in stand-up and a really cool thing that can translate to the corporate world. You know, how can you get on their side of their objection and sort of see what their point is and let them know you're an ally and you're working together on something.
In the Harley case, our friend asked them, okay, so it's the worst ad you've ever seen. What is it you don't like about it? And when they expressed their objections, it turns out it was just a small part of the thing didn't work. And all they had to do was solve that part. And suddenly they had their business. People are so, they're not used to being listened to.
Correct. Oh, it's so true.
So you know, you probably know some of this stuff. I was gonna say, you probably know some of this stuff from the dating stuff. It's like when you want to break up with someone because they don't, you know, open the door for you. And then it's like, well, did you ever ask them to open the door for you? And suddenly you're like, oh my God, I'm with someone who listens and cares about my wants. And right.
There's nothing as charismatic and sexy about deeply listening to another person. So that is a big part of what stand-ups have to do.
I agree. It's what I have taught my students is get genuinely curious about a woman and she'll become fascinated with you and view you as someone who's 5 inches taller than you really are. That's rich. Let's move on here. All right. So what are three comedy skills you can immediately use to improve your sales and communication? Why, here they are. You've told me. Flow, authenticity, and unflappability. We've talked about unflappability. Let's talk about flow, because I know a good comedy set has to have transitions. It has to flow. You can't suddenly switch, or maybe you can. I don't know. I'm not a comic. I'm just a big fan of comedy.
I mean, I think one thing that helps with flow is just not feeling like things are off limits. You know, we talk a lot about how it used to be in the 80s, you know, every ad was like a buttoned up person, you know, and now it's like you turn on TV and it's like people have tattoos and people have piercings, or there was that big thing during the pandemic where there was like a newscaster who had a kid like crawl across the background of the screen. And it's like when those moments happen, can you not, don't pretend they're not happening, sort of acknowledge them and let somebody see that you're a whole person. You know, so I think flow can sometimes just come from, we call it sometimes calling the secret of the room, where you sort of, you say the thing that's on everybody's mind, that's nobody's saying, you know what I mean? And people will exhale. It's like, you know, when you watch a comedian and they're not having a good set and they're bombing, if that comedian is pretending they're having a good set, it's the most uncomfortable thing in the world. Cause you're like, oh my God, they don't know. I'm so uncomfortable for them. But if you're a comedian and you have a joke and it doesn't hit and you go, wow, you guys really didn't like that one. People laugh. They're on your side because they go, oh, okay, this person isn't full of it. They're reacting to what's really going on. So I think that we challenge people with exercises that make them stretch a little bit and be a little more vulnerable, show a little more skin than maybe they're used to in the workplace. Now, we're not saying walk into every meeting and go, I'm going through a divorce, you know, but when you're not afraid of being yourself and allowing yourself in a little bit more, even if you're not practicing it, that fearlessness, it contributes to your flow. And I think it just makes people really magnetic.
Fantastico. Jerry, you want to add to that?
One of the other things we do, so once we get people into that, teach them how to access that state of calm, we then sort of try to expand their palette of unflappability and flow by teaching them some improv exercises. Right. So improv is really important, and it's sort of to the point that Heather's making. You're going through life, something happens that is unexpected, and you can, again, either reject that it's happening or accept that it's happening and build off of it. So improv really teaches us how to just take whatever the client is giving you, whatever the impediment to what, where you thought it was going to go, how to take that and flow with it. And that's just so important. We have a series of improv games. We also have a neat one that Heather leads, which is about status. This is, can you tell them about that, Anne?
Yeah, so basically it's a game that helps us uncover how sometimes we have unconscious biases. Like, you know, you might go into a meeting with someone that you're like, oh my God, I think they're a genius. Everything they say is so smart. But you might go into a meeting with someone else and, you know, maybe you holding a grudge towards them. You don't even realize it's because they like didn't CC you on an email 3 years ago or whatever, right? Like we all have these human things that we're holding on to. And through this exercise, we split people into groups. We attribute certain statuses to them. Like, okay, you think this person's a genius or this person always has bad ideas. And we have them first do the exercise without any statuses. We just go, how many ideas can you come up with for this prompt? And we time it. They do the ideas. Then they do it again after attributing statuses. And what we find is it really, the ideas flow much better when you don't have all these conceptions about people, when you're not going like, oh, well, their ideas are always bad, or oh, here comes the guy who never likes my ideas, or whatever the things are that we have in our minds of how we're going to be received or how we're going to receive someone else. And what's cool about this exercise is you actually realize that you can control the quality of your interactions before they even begin by deciding before you get in a room with someone that their contributions matter, you know, and not to sort of hold back in the ways that we sometimes do in these unconscious ways. So we time them and everyone's always surprised to find, you know, it's a hard exercise to explain. So hopefully it's making sense how I'm sort of saying it.
The idea is that if you can attribute someone a higher status than you would normally do, then suddenly the interaction changes. And if you can yes. wipe away some of those sort of predetermined negative biases that we have toward people that we don't realize we have, if we can just clear that slate, then the whole interaction is going to go so much better.
Even as simple as you're pitching business to someone, the difference between going, oh, I need their business and they're my client and you know, they're above me and they have decision-making power, or are you looking at it like we're collaborating, we're sitting on the same side of the table, we're two people with the same goal, like just those little shifts, you know, can make a big difference.
This actually leads to another tool that we teach. We call it CPR, and it stands for context, purpose, results. We developed this a long time ago. It's not entirely our own, but we were the first to apply it, I think, to what our context was. First, we applied it to stand-up comedy. Let me go a little deeper here. So your default context as a stand-up comedian, if you don't do any of this work, is your context is, gee, I hope they like me. I hope they like me. And it is a very weak context to come from. However, before I go on stage, I go, well, what is my context? What is my purpose tonight? And what are the results I hope to achieve? And if my purpose is to make people feel less alone, and my context is, we're all a little crazy and that's okay. And if my result is that I get people to think about their lives differently, and then I walk on stage, it matters less about whether they like me because I have my own set of internal agendas.
And attainable agendas, right?
Right, that don't actually require, that it's not so externally validated. It's internally validated.
Yes.
We bring this over to a sales context. It makes someone walk into the room. Again, we're talking about charisma. We're talking about confidence. Again, salespeople aren't really ever taught these soft skills. Not just sales. I mean, marketing people, HR people, they have to give presentations. How are they giving presentations without this full suite of skills that Heather learned at acting school at NYU and I learned from Jeff Goldblum at the Playhouse West? These are things that all performers and actors know and almost none of our business contacts know.
I learned it picking up women. I mean, it's, it's the same principle.
Sounds like a more fun way to learn it, Paul.
Well, yeah, you know, but it can be nastier in the results.
Oh, I guess so.
No.
Failing at that seems a little rough for sure.
No, there's no failure. There's feedback. You mentioned improv. I love it. Let's play a little improv game. You weren't expecting this. So I am the south end of a duck flying north.
What's the game? How do we play? We don't know what you're doing. It.
Go, okay. I am the cloud that the duck is flying through. Never mind.
Offline, you'll teach us this game. We can't wait to learn it.
Yeah, it's a fun game. I played improv for a little while. What are the top three mistakes you see, I think you, I can intuit it from what you've already said, but what do you think of the top three mistakes influencers are making today? And by influencers, I mean across the spectrum. I don't mean people who are online posting their Instagram of them wearing a thong bikini that's been highly artificially put through an AI.
I think withholding your real self, you know, withholding some the flaws that make us imperfect and make us so likable and so personable. You know, I have a different job where I'm writing for a television show, and we have these room leaders that help us write jokes for this show. And I have the best room leader. He said the other day, he said he sometimes like kills the jokes before they get on if they're not right. And he said, I was in a bad mood. Maybe I killed too many jokes yesterday. And it was just so human of him as a leader to go, you know what? I think I made a mistake, or I was too harsh, or I was too this. And it allowed us to trust him more. I think a lot of people who are in powerful positions feel like they're never allowed to make a mistake, right, or show that they're human. And I think it's counterintuitive, but when you do those things, people want to follow you even more. So I think that is a big mistake people make, is just inauthenticity.
What really resonates with me as you say that is, to be a leader, I think, whether it's a CEO or a leader of a sales team or in your personal life, I've always said you have to go first. Don't expect somewhere to go where you're not willing to go first. Mm-hmm. Going first doesn't necessarily giving commands or giving orders. It means emotionally you take that state that you want people to be in, and you have to experience it for yourself. It's not something that you can push one way. I think the start of that bridge.
You know, Jerry and I both have 3-year-olds, and I think I see that so much in parenting. It's like, unfortunately, they learn to react the way you react. They don't listen to whatever you're saying. They just see, oh, you're allowed to yell when you're mad. Well, then I'm allowed to yell when I'm mad, you know? So that resonates a lot with me.
It's just a mind blow for me, because ladies and gentlemen, I knew Heather when she
you knew me when I was a 3-year-old,
and now you have a 3-year-old, and you have children,
and you stay the same age, Paul. It's so crazy. And you stay the same. You stay the same age. It's so crazy.
I don't know about that. I have a little bit less hair. Heather could reveal my nickname on the air, but that would blow my cover.
I could. I don't.
Yeah, you know my nickname that all the kids call me.
Oh.
Yeah.
I think I do.
You do. Well, wait a minute. Let me ask you a question. Jerry and Heather, you obviously have a great rapport. How did you guys connect professionally?
So I took Jerry's stand-up class, which, by the way, he's so humble when he talks about it. It's like one of the best stand-up classes in Los Angeles. It's won all the awards. He gets like best instructor and backstage and all this stuff. I took his stand-up class over 10 years ago. Because you have to stop counting after 10 in Los Angeles. And I always joke that I just stayed in the class and never left until I finally convinced him to let me teach with him, which is actually pretty much what happened. But he has an amazing class, and he has a program where once you've taken the class and you're alumni, you can sit in and pitch on other people's jokes. And I just sort of did that religiously. And Jerry has taught me so much. And then the pandemic happened. We both had babies on the way, and there was a lot of corporate stuff where people were looking for things. And, you know, we preferred the in-person ones because they're so fun, but we were able to work over Zoom as well. So we sort of started doing more of these corporate things. And now we just do everything we can together.
Yeah.
I love that. You know, this always occurs to me. I just want to ask you a question about comedy in general, because I've found some comics can make a really mean edge work. They just have a mean edge to them. They're just mean, and it's funny. Somehow they pack their mean in a way where it's okay to be mean. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Sure. Don Rickles is a great example.
Well, without even being insulting, they're just comics who you know who Darren Frost is? Darren Frost is a Canadian. He is a Canadian comedian. He's one of the meanest, coolest, funniest people I've ever seen. Yeah. He has been attacked by hecklers. I mean, physically attacked, had bottles thrown at him. And he has a thing in his contract. When you do a show, it always has to say rated X, no refunds on this show. He is mean-spirited. He's mean-spirited and he's funny as I can curse on this show. He's funny as fuck.
Yeah.
But you've seen comics with them.
I mean, I would say we want people to find their authentic funny, you know, like don't come into comedy and go like, I decide I want to be one of those mean comics. Like that won't work. You know what I mean? But I think if you're someone that is authentically how you make jokes, I think it's a harder thing to pull off and to hone because, you know, people are going to love you or people are going to hate you. But if that's who you are and you can really commit to it and, you know, you have to be brilliantly funny, right? It's like, we have certain things where it's like, if you're going to do a joke and you're going to like, we call it punching down, right? Make fun of somebody else instead of yourself or whatever. It's like that laugh better really be worth it because you're going out on that limb, you know? So in a sense, those comics can feel funnier when they hit because they have to be funnier to sort of earn the right to kind of crap on everybody, you know?
It sounds to me like you have to walk a line between shocking people and getting in and making sure they don't dislike you.
Yeah, I mean, I think that sometimes this happens more with newer comics, but sometimes people will mistake shocked, uncomfortable laughter for regular laughter. And it's like, that's not the laughter you want. You know, it's like you can get out there and just be blue and say something gross and people will laugh because they're kind of like, ha, it's like, but you're not eliciting the feeling that you actually want them to walk away with.
Here's a big question I want to ask both of you.
I just want to add to what you were just asking about. One of the exercises that we give people, and this is less for the corporate world, but more for just those who want to be funnier and understand the guy you're talking about, Terry Frost, understands his funny. It is his, he could try to be a real positive comedian, but that wouldn't be in line with who he is. So one of the things that we have people do when they come to us is we ask them to write down what they say whenever they make someone laugh. So their friend says, I like, you know, your friend says, I liked you better when you used to drink. You're like, I liked you better when I used to drink. Okay, good, boom. Okay, so you write it down. And then your friend says this and you write down this. And then your friend says that and you say that, write it down. After you do this about 10 times, you're gonna start to notice, oh, this is my unique way. This is my own shorthand for how I get laughs. And if you can start to, we call it the comedy DNA exercise. So everyone's got their own specific and unique comedy DNA. As long as you can tune into what yours is, and it might be very unexpected. You might go, sometimes the nicest people are the meanest comedians, but they just have that teasing older brother kind of comedy. That's what they need to lean into. So that's sort of, Will Rogers also has. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say it's fun because it's surprising. Like I find myself when I'm like writing things down, I'm like, oh, I do voices. It's like we all these things like, oh, wait, I do songs. Oh, I do numbers jokes. Like, you know, when you're just being naturally funny the way you are in conversation, you don't notice. So it can really be a helpful hack to keep track of those and then you can do them more intentionally.
And Will Rogers, you know, who's a famous old, you know, beyond comedian, he was a whole phenomenon to himself. But he had a quote where he said something essentially like, if there's no malice in your heart, the audience won't feel any malice in your gags. Mm. And I think that some of the most insulting comedians have, you know, Rickles was known to have a really warm heart, you know, yeah. But he was very mean. So as long as they're not really hateful inside, the audience doesn't feel it.
Got it. I'm just thinking of humor. Well, first of all, let me bring up a point or make this both a point and a question. I think there's a distinction between having a sense of humor and being a clown, being someone who's constantly looking for validation through being funny, who can't get off the whole entertainer thing and engage in a real conversation where they're exchanging information. So what do you do to make sure your clients, if you're going into these situations, sales situations, or their CEOs who want to be better at leadership, what do you do to make sure they understand the distinction between being an entertainer who's constantly, and here's another one, and just being using humor in a way that creates rapport and builds leadership?
I don't think we run into that too often because most of the time in the corporate context, there isn't that sort of Yuckmeister guy. You know what I mean?
Like, I think also like, unfortunately in our 1 or 2 hour workshops, we can't really turn you into Amy Schumer, you know, for your next corporate meeting. So that sort of, you know, doesn't happen that often, but I know what you're talking about.
What we're talking about really is authenticity. And if someone's being authentic, then they're not then they're able to engage on a real level. And if someone's being superficial, and, you know, I once heard Dangerfield on a talk show. It was that show Loveline with Adam Carolla and Dr. Drew.
Yes, Dr. Drew.
It was so frustrating because people were calling in with real questions. Dr. Drew and Adam were trying to ask him real questions, and he simply wouldn't drop his shtick. And it was just, it was frustrating for them. It was frustrating for listeners because we wanted to know the person. We wanted to know the man. Now, look, I can't argue with Rodney Dangerfield. He had a career. It worked well. Yeah. But I think at the end of the day, you know, one of the things that Heather and I train that we haven't really talked about is something that we call structured vulnerability. And in this exercise, we get people, well, I don't want to give away the whole exercise, but
give a little bit, give a taste.
It's not going to sound that impactful, but you'll just have to follow it as best as you can. So first we have people introduce themselves with their name, their job title, and then we have them share with their partner, if people are paired up, share with their partner a story about a moment in their lives that changed their life. It can be a 30-second long story. And then we have the partners help them match their name, their job title, with what happened. And this is strange, right? Because you go, well, you know, someone tells a story about how they cared for their elderly mother. Someone tells a story about how they were, you know, they overcame a terrible disease. And you think, well, what does that have to do? But in fact, what ends up happening is the person who works for quality assurance at Google realized that taking care of their mother and that those completely overlap, that in fact, what their entire life is about is to make sure that no balls are dropped, that all the plates are kept spinning. And that is, in fact, their legacy. And by getting people to do that, two things happen. First, they get a greater sense of job satisfaction to some degree and the moment of recognition that, in fact, their job is an extension of their greater life. But secondly, most of the time, people have never shared. One of our favorite quotes on our website, comedypartners.com, one of our favorite quotes is from someone at Amazon who said, "My team has been together for 10 years and they have never opened up to each other the way they did today." And this again goes to your initial question about what is charisma? When you have had the experience of being trained how to share the not so tidy parts of your life, and you've had the opportunity in a safe environment to share with your coworkers and colleagues something about yourself that they would never know any other way, suddenly that opens up your palate. It's now expanded and you are unafraid to be vulnerable, real, charismatic, and authentic. And that is what the Comedy Partners teach people.
That's fantastic. I think that's something that will spread across contexts in people's lives. It's not just something you carry forward in your business, but I could easily see how this would spread over into personal life and every other form of interaction. We have reached the end of our time together, unfortunately. However, a couple of things are going to happen. Once we get off the air, I'm going to have a conversation with you, Heather Pasternak, about we can connect when I'm back
yes.
up for Shabbat dinner. Jerry, I do remember you. I absolutely do remember you. It was a long time ago. Even at my advanced age, I still have a memory. All right. So how do people stay in the conversation with you? I know they're going to want to.
Yes.
Best way to go. You hit them ahead.
I was just going to say, you can find out more about us and contact us at thecomedypartners.com. And we would love to hear you from you and get to know you. So,
and if you have a company that would love to, if you have workers or yourself or your colleagues would like to become more charismatic, authentic, better at presentations, better at sales, we'd love to talk to you and give you some.
Or you just need a team building workshop, come find us.
Offsites.
Yeah.
This has been a fantastic episode. I knew it would be. Stay with me in the green room when we're done.
Okay.
All right. So we'll
Thank
see you.
Thank you.
Oh, of course. We'll see you again on The Influencer's Edge. Bye now.
The Influencer's Edge is brought to you by the Rapid Sales Accelerator. If you're ready to skyrocket your sales by 30% or more in just 90 days, then you need to claim your free training right now. You'll learn 4 words that will compel your prospects to trust you like they were children within the first 3 to 5 minutes of any conversation, across any platform and any medium. You'll learn how to give your prospects objection amnesia, to crush objections like, I need to talk to my spouse, or I need more time to think it over, or it's too expensive. And finally, you'll get a free recorded audio training that will install unbelievable attitudes for success and wipe out any limiting beliefs. So if you'd like to claim your free training now, go to www.paulrossbook.com. Do it before your competition does it now. Thank you for tuning in to the Influencer's Edge, where you get the latest breakthroughs, cutting-edge insights, tools, and techniques so you can leapfrog over the pack in sales, influence, and persuasion. Remember to visit our website at www.theinfluencersedge.com to enjoy even more great episodes like this one. We look forward to seeing you again on the Influencer's Edge Show.